Hello, Sublation Magazine readers, Sublation Media watchers. It's I, Douglas Lane. This episode, we're going to be discussing the Tucker Carlson and Putin interview. To my left, if I'm looking out from the screen at myself, to my right as I'm looking at the screen is Reed Kane. Reed, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, Doug. My name is Reed Kane. I am a independent scholar or, student, I would probably more accurate to say, of Marxism. I'm a member of the Platypus Affiliated Society. I am on Twitter at Socialist Legacy, post there somewhat regularly. I'm also going to be leading a series of seminars for the School of Materialist Research starting this Saturday for the next five Saturdays on the subject of the dialectic of theory and practice in Marx and Engels, which there's information about that on my Twitter if you are interested. So
all right,
that's who I am.
So again, welcome to Sublation Magazine show. Ashley Frawley is not going to be part of the show this week, but she'll be back next week. And here's our intro.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets such as military bases and chemical plants may be advised to evacuate.
Pasta is imitating me in the comments saying, hello, everyone. It is I. Yeah, it is I, your leader in the Laneism of Marxism. All right. So, Reed, you and I both watched the Tucker Carlson Putin interview. I guess we should start by talking about the reaction in the United States, in the media, and amongst the political class to the announcement that this interview was going to take place. It was apparently suppressed on Facebook. I've seen reports that it was a shadow banned on Facebook. So if you posted it there, the number of people who would see it, was artificially suppressed. That there was talk about sanctioning or in some way charging Tucker Carlson with a crime, maybe not letting him get back in the United States. Phil Kristol was saying crazy things like he should be in The Hague or something like that. What did you think about the reaction to the fact that Tucker Carlson went to Moscow and interviewed Putin?
I obviously it's a lot of hysteria. I don't know. I don't recall this level of, I guess there wasn't like an active war going on at the time, if I recall correctly, but I don't recall this kind of hysteria when Oliver Stone interviewed Putin back in 2017, I think mm-hmm. It was. It's obvious they're trying to stir up this anti-Russia, hysteria amongst the Democratic Party base as part of the effort to undermine Trump's presidential candidacy. And I don't really, I think it's just kind of obviously absurd. Tucker Carlson is kind of trying to be a journalist. He's really more of a pundit than a journalist, but he's interviewing a world leader that we have as Glenn Greenwald put it, the American people obviously have an interest in knowing what Putin has to say. So, should we be afraid of hearing what he has to say? Like, is this like Russian propaganda to hear that? Maybe it is, but like, obviously anyone watching it would have to think, well, of course, Putin's speaking in his own interests and the interests of the country he leads. So why, it's not like that's being hidden or something. So I just think it's like a spectacle. It's absurd, Yeah, that's all I can really make of it.
To me, it's a sign of weakness on the part of the establishment that they reacted the way that they did. And mm-hmm. It's just part and parcel of the overall attempt in the last, nearly a decade now, like 6-7 years, to control the media in the United States and the kind of desperate attempt to put the lid on the internet, on the on social media and independent journalism. I wonder, with when it comes to Tucker, what's the distinction between journalist and pundit?
I don't know. I mean, does Tucker Carlson like break stories or does he comment on what's happening? Like, I'm not like some, I haven't been, you know, deeply following his career or anything like that. But, you know, as far as I know, he's mostly been, you know, a host on various cable news shows where, you know, he's engaged in commentary on what's going on. He's not doing investigative journalism or things like that. You know, I don't mean to deprecate him, but, you know, I think there was I saw accusations that he was kind of throwing a lot of softballs at Putin, which, you know, I'm sure he could have been tougher, but I felt like he seemed a bit more perplexed and like almost unprepared in a way that I don't know if it works to Putin's advantage exactly. I think it if anything, it makes the interview seem, I don't know, I felt it to be a bit of like an overwhelming thing to watch in that there was very little clarity for me coming out of it. It just seemed like Putin was laying on a lot of his perspective. And it's not that Carlson wasn't pushing back on it, but he was pushing back on it as if he like just couldn't really make sense of it, as opposed to like trying to get him to, as opposed to like really challenging him in any kind of substantive ways. I mean, there were a few places where he didn't, mm-hmm. but for the most part, he seemed like he couldn't even really get a grip on Putin's perspective, you know, or, you know, that, well, especially during that first part of the interview.
Understand why Tucker might have felt that way. And it wasn't necessarily that he was unprepared, although maybe he was. But first of all, it's standard for Tucker to make that look of being perplexed. That's usually true. It's a rhetorical gesture that he does when he's talking to someone who's maybe on the left, who he wants to communicate to his audience what they're saying is absurd. He would make that perplexed look, but I think in this case it was a spontaneous look, and I can understand it, because you ask, you know, you've said that you were concerned about a surprise attack from you through Ukraine if Ukraine was allowed to be a de facto member of NATO or a member of NATO, and that seems absurd to American ears. But tell me why you think that's a legitimate concern. And Putin's reaction is, well, in the year 862, there was this prince that came in and started Rus, which was the first nation of Russia. And then later we adopted Orthodoxy. It's, you know, we baptized the nation as Orthodox. It's like, you know, okay, that's not an answer to the question I was asking. And that seems like you know, maybe didn't hear me. That would be my
yeah. or like Tucker put it in that kind of like little prologue he did, you know, he suspected Putin might just be like kind of filibustering and like trying to avoid answering any real questions by, you know, spouting off, you know, at length on vaguely related topics. But he also, you know, said he kind of came to the conclusion that, no, this is how this guy really thinks, which, you know, maybe it is. But it's just, if so, I just think it speaks to like this, you know, that it's not really enlightening, because if that's really how he thinks about these issues, then he's not really grappling with, you know, what's actually happening in the world. I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I can only see this from a total outsider perspective and think, is this really how someone leading one of the largest, most powerful countries in the world thinks about what he's doing? Like in terms of 1,000 years of, you know, ethnic, you know, conflicts and whatnot, on the borders of this territory and all that. It's just, it did seem a little bit, dishonest in a way, but I don't know if that's exactly Putin like putting Tucker on. I think maybe that really is how you know, Putin's administration wants this to be perceived. And I don't know. I mean, maybe that's how it's discussed in Russia. I have no way of knowing that, but, you know. Well,
I've been working on promoting an upcoming book, which I'll mention again here, which is Jack Ross's book, The Strange Death of American Exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things about the book for me, and something that was challenging as I read the book to decide whether I was going to accept it, and also now that I'm working on promoting it, was that it comes from a perspective which is not orthodox Marxist or even progressive liberal. It grants some of the ideas and ideologies of people like Samuel Huntington, which is that, you know, the cultural or ethnic ideologies or
the clash of civilizations.
Yeah. Should be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And have played a significant role in forming and directing the political life and the political history of the United States. And it's interesting in the case of the United States because the idea of the melting pot of different ethnic groups is central to the book. So it is the working through of integration and modernization and secularization of these ethno-religious ideologies in the United States. So if you try to step back and look at what Putin is saying as a symptom, maybe, of the incomplete process of modernization in the Soviet Union, or that was supposed to occur through the Soviet Union and then now is still not complete in modern Russia, maybe it makes more sense that you've got a world leader who really does, on some level, even as he also can think on other levels, think about the world in terms of ethno states and religious ideologies.
I think part, you know, that might be part of it, but I think another big part of it not to overlook is the extent of the regression that must have, you know, that did occur in Russia with the fall of the Soviet Union and the implementation of shock therapy. I mean, it was really a devastating decade. The 90s was a devastating decade for your average Russian citizen. I mean, not just because of like this shattering of a certain ideological pretense, however thin that might have gotten by that point. But, you know, I mean, just in terms of bread and butter, I mean, you know, unemployment for one thing, and concomitantly suicide rates, alcoholism rates, various other symptomatic, you know, various other things that are symptomatic of social decline, severe social decline, skyrocketed very quickly and really didn't start abating until after Putin came to power. So, you know, I mean, that's a traumatic series of events over a very compressed period of time, which something that, you know, historically Russia has had to deal with, but we're talking about people that haven't been alive since 1917, let alone before that. You know, we're talking especially today about people that were relatively young or some, you know, not even born at that time, who've only lived with the aftermath of it. So how do you recover from that sort of thing in terms of, you know, a kind of cultural self-understanding? You know, obviously, you'd turn towards maybe more conservative ideas. And that's just a reflection of the impulse that, you know, pragmatically speaking, someone like Putin was, you know, necessary to essentially hold Russia together in that context, which is not like any kind of praise of Putin or something. But, you know, what the United States and its, you know, the kind of international capitalist system, so to speak, put Russia through was devastating. And also, it really kind of transformed what was a sort of, I mean, you could look at like, you know, the Soviet bureaucracy as like a corrupt racket, which it was, but it was at least, you know, stable and consolidated. And they really turned it into something much more, you know, piratical, like people really just kind of looting wealth from the state and taking it out of the country, and enriching themselves in the process. So, you know, that's a very, you know, how do you hold society together in that context? What do you reach to? What do you reach for? You know, I mean, religion certainly makes sense. You know, cultural, ethnic, national identity makes sense, sadly. But what else are you going to do? You know, so I'd imagine that does play to some extent. But it also, you know, one thing that I found striking is that as much as Putin was willing to go into like 1,000 years of history of this scenario, I found his account of the relationship between Ukraine and Russia in this, in the 20th century, very lacking. And he said multiple times that with respect to Lenin and Stalin, there was, you know, he didn't understand, nobody understood why they did what they did. I know, perhaps I missed, you had mentioned to me before we started that he had said maybe some vaguely ambivalent or positive things about Lenin and the national policy with respect to Ukraine. But I was struck by the fact that multiple times he kind of said, inexplicable, nobody understands. And that would really be the relevant history to understand, not what happened in 800 AD or whatever, you know? So the fact that he can't really even broach that subject in a substantial way, to me, that was like, well, why can't we, like, what is the barrier here to discussing this problem? And I think it really has to do with the sense in which the history of the Soviet Union has to just be assimilated as an episode in this broader Russian history, and one that doesn't exactly make sense in retrospect, you know, which is kind of true.
So I want to point out something. We've got a comment here from Kushluk. It says, Putin is very smart compared to the complete intellectual bankruptcy of the Americans. We'll see how intelligence factors into world politics. And then, again, from a Machiavellian perspective, it's almost a perfect experiment. Smart player with poor cards, Russia, versus a drooling idiot with all the advantages, USA. Now, I want to, not to defend the United States' policies at all, or to claim that the person in the White House is sharp as a tack or anything like that. But I think that this whole, that was one of the things that was immediately apparent if you were just watching the media cycle when the Tucker Carlson interview dropped, was that it was impossible to avoid the comparison of mental acuity between Biden and Putin. Even if you didn't particularly care for or weren't even able to completely follow Putin's approach to answering questions, there was no doubt that Putin displayed a grasp of the facts and a mental acuity and intelligence that Biden has a difficulty presenting from sentence to sentence when he speaks publicly or in an interview. Biden is much more confused, it seems, than Putin is. But to that comparison, I think misleads us, because the question isn't about the conflict as a game of chess between these two men.
Right.
You know, this is historically determined conflict. It's arising out of not the history of Russia dating back to 862, but certainly it's arising out of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And so we should try to understand the smarter player's perspective and not think of and think about what the outcomes are going to be, not based on his understanding alone, but based on taking up his understanding and seeing what we can understand from the situation and from what he says, and having the opportunity to listen to Putin's explanation for his invasion of Russia.
I don't know how smart Putin is. I mean, he certainly seems like competent with respect to like what he is there to do, you know, or at least he's not, you know, blatantly incompetent. Again, looking at this from like kind of an outsider perspective. But you know, he's like a brutal gangster, you know, he's like a warlord really, you know, somewhat more, you know, straight laced than, you know, maybe your more, negligible warlords in other parts of the world. But, that's what he is. He's a gangster. He's like the head gangster of a gangster empire. You know, which is really what the Soviet Union was turned into through that shock therapy policy. And again, it kind of was that already in a different way, but in a much more organized and disciplined way, even at, you know, the height of, and I, you know, organized and disciplined in a certain sense, obviously. But you know, it's, he's, you know, he's a brutal gangster. The United States has plenty of brutal gangsters making important decisions, both in terms of the state, but also obviously the private sector as well. But we don't really see or hear from them at all. You know, that they're not in the spotlight. That's not what Biden is. Like the president of the United States is not like what Putin is, even if Putin has a certain constitutional position. He's like the, he's like the head bureaucrat, you know, that's why he's been in power for what, like 2020, what he came to power in 2000, I think. I mean, he was kind of already, he was already there in the 90s in more of a background role, but you know, he's in that position because he's holding together this workable, relatively speaking, workable structure of state power. But you know, the president is really, you know, who, what is the president, or what is any elected official, at least in, you know, in the United States, what are they? They're civilians that are elected by the civilian population to oversee the affairs of the government, to be in charge ostensibly of the government. But you know, they're really a representative of society that's being, you know, put on top of this bureaucratic apparatus that already exists and is already, you know, doing what it's doing, regardless of who's in elected office. Now that's not to say there's no, it's not to say that it's completely hollowed out and there's no, you know, give and take. There is, but the deep state, you know, that's like a real thing. And it really is autonomous of the civilian authority of elected officials. And to the extent that the political parties have any pull over it, it's because that bureaucratic apparatus is in the political parties and is, you know, the heart of those parties. It's not because the political parties actually represent what the citizens want or something. Like, for example, with Trump, when he was president, you know, there's you know, a lot of people like to say, you know, Trump said he was going to do all these things he didn't do, or he tried to do all these things and he failed, and so on. And it's like, yeah, because he's one guy that went in and tried to like take on the most, you know, massive, most powerful apparatus of state power that's ever existed. And you know, the fact that he was able to do anything at all is kind of remarkable. But it speaks to, you know, a degree of popular support and so on. Biden is obviously a figurehead in ways that, you know, really, certainly every president since at least, you know, I would say probably since at least Harry Truman, if not earlier than that, has really been kind of a figurehead of power brokers behind the scenes that we don't really see or hear from very much, if at all. And, you know, not like there's one guy behind the scenes that's really in power. It's a complex web of various overlapping institutions, organizations, public and private, that are engaged in a constant tug of war with each other in terms of coordinating the affairs of this massive system of political stabilization of the economic system. So it's, you know, it's, is Biden like a incompetent, you know, obviously he's like clearly losing his mental faculties very rapidly. I think I even saw Hillary Clinton admitted that in an interview, I think like last week. And she did it in the context of saying it is, I think she said something like, being asked that question, she said something like, it is a concern. You know, of course it's a concern. It's a concern with Trump as well, but yes, it's a concern. So she was kind of like trying to pull this, like, well, we should be concerned about Trump's age as well. Mm-hmm. But she had to sort of admit, like, but with Biden, yeah, it's a real concern. So I don't know. Does that hurt Biden's, like, election chances or whatever? I don't know if people are voting for Joe Biden. I think they're probably more voting for the Democratic Party, you know, mm-hmm. And whatever that represents in terms of having some vague direction given to this massive bureaucratic system. Does the US look weak compared to Russia by contrast with, like, Putin? Yeah, but it's like we're supposed to want the government to be weak in that sense. If anything, the problem is it's not as weak as it looks, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an interesting dilemma. One of the things that Putin, who's been there for nearly a quarter of a century in power, complained about is that you know, he would make an agreement with one American or one world leader, and then that would be overturned later. Now, not necessarily by the next person to be elected, although that could happen, but also by the deep state.
By his own, you know, supposedly his own subordinates, you know?
Right, right.
But
so one of the things that came out of that interview that I'm not sure if it was a propaganda point that Putin was trying to make, I'm sure it was, but also struck me as somewhat true, was that we don't have a political system which can be moved very easily from the course that it's been on for a long time. There's some entrenched interests within the state that perpetuate a particular approach to world affairs, which is violent and intrusive, and which is fundamentally disrespectful of national sovereignty and democratic rule and the bourgeois norms. And I don't think anyone who's been paying attention can deny that. It did make sense to me that Putin would be frustrated with the way in which he was treated by the Clinton administration, for instance, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, once he took power in the year 2000. And one of the things that I first started to think about and ask about and kind of said rhetorically after the invasion of Ukraine was, why isn't Russia a member of NATO? Or to put differently, why isn't Russia integrated into the EU? Why is Russia not fully integrated into liberal bourgeois market economic globalization? After all, we were told after the collapse of the Soviet Union that we'd reached the end of history and that our task was to bring liberal modernity to full fruition around the world. And you know, that was Fukuyama who said that, but it was also taken up by the Bush administration at the time, Bush Senior. And it while that might not be a system which produces absolute equity internally to domestic populations, one of the promises was that we wouldn't have another Cold War. We wouldn't have this prolonged tension of global conflict defining our affairs going forward. But it seems to actually have continued all along. The Cold War never really ended. And that's something else that came out of the Putin interview, at least for me, and something I kind of already knew, but which was confirmed and deepened by listening to Putin talk. Did you get something like that out of the conversation?
Yeah, I thought that was, you know, I think some of the most interesting, some of the most interesting comments on Putin's part was kind of rehearsing this history, which, as far as I know, he wasn't lying, you know, in terms of essentially being jerked around by the United States and its various leaders over multiple decades. You know, yeah, Russia was jerked around. My understanding, again, not as an expert of any kind, but just based on my own, you know, what I know about the subject, you know, the United States wanted Russia to remain weak after the fall of the Soviet Union. And Putin's rise to power represented an effort to, again, consolidate something stable in terms of political leadership in Russia that the United States was, you know, did not like. They were freaked out by that. And so I think, you know, if Bill Clinton was, you know, willing to consider admitting Russia to NATO, I think, you know, I'm sure he probably was considering that, but I think his foreign policy advisors were like, we don't want to do anything that will allow Russia to recoup any kind of position that can pose a kind of plausible threat to this new political order we're trying to establish in Eastern Europe and in, you know, in the world more generally. So, you know, I think that's probably why they were jerking Putin around, you know, because they didn't want, you know, they probably wanted to keep him on the back foot. But ultimately they don't want Russia to be like a recognized and legitimized actor. They want it to be kind of in a weaker position. And the stronger Putin is able to, you know, pose, you know, himself in the geopolitical order, the less likely they are to accept any kind of like rapprochement with him, you know? So that's just my sense of it. But I also think, you know, important to take into consideration with respect to like the end of history idea, you know, is that the political order of capitalism that we currently still live in based on essentially, you know, essentially the United States is essentially like the global government, more or less. You know, it has like these various, you know, institutions that represent its political power on the international scene in various ways. But ultimately, it's the United States' military force that has, since World War II, allowed global trade to function as it does. You know, and part of that was containment of the Soviet Union and so on. But to some extent, containment was in a, you know, to some extent, containment was like an, you know, a rationalization for maintaining military presence around the world for other reasons, namely to facilitate a stable system of global trade in the absence of the kind of capitalist order you had before World War One, then that culminated in World War One, where you had, you know, Britain essentially played an analogous role to the one that the United States has since any of us have been alive. But it was a different, they did it in a different way. You know, they did it through, obviously they had their own overseas empire, you know, their own overseas, you know, political possessions and so on. And there were other competing empires or, you know, or what have you, like, you know, it was like a system of conflicting empires in a sense. But the whole point of British foreign policy throughout that period was to maintain a balance between these ostensibly antagonistic imperial powers so that you had kind of everything balancing each other out so you could maintain a stable system of commerce in spite of, you know, potential conflicts between them. So, you know, you really have, you know, playing these powers against each other and using Britain's, you know, economic and military and political superiority to keep this whole thing going. And then eventually that broke down, you know, obviously, but the United States took a very different approach after World War II. You know, as much as you might want to call the United States an imperialist power, and it is in a sense, but it did, you know, it's the imperial character of the American state is very different. And the way it's maintained, you know, a global capitalist order over the past, you know, 70 or 80 years, is very different from the way Britain did it. What you've seen since like the 70s has been an increasingly evident crisis in that order and a kind of increasing deterioration of its elements, both domestically within the United States and around the world, that's leading to sort of a push back towards, you know, away from this system of independent national states, towards, you know, there's a kind of increasing tendency towards growing imperial or pseudo-imperial presence. But does that represent like a fundamental shift towards, first of all, that's not to look at like the British example that I was mentioning. that wasn't like multipolar in the way people talk about like multipolar, a multipolar world. It was unipolar. Britain was the pole. Everything else was dependent on Britain's role. And to the extent that it fell apart, it's not because something else replaced it. I mean, the United States was, you know, obviously an independent country, but what is the United States if not, you know, from its origins, the outpost of Britain in the New World? You know, it obviously became a lot more than that, but you know, what we're really talking about is a shift of footing of like the hegemon of the world market from a war ravaged Europe and a war ravaged Britain to this massive rising power on in the New World. So in that sense, are we moving towards like back towards like a multipolar system? No, but there is a shift in the system that we have away from what has worked for the last 70 years, more or less, towards something else. But what is that something else? That's the question that seems very uncertain right now. And I don't know if anyone is like in a position, I don't think anyone is in a position to decide what it's going to be. It's going to have to be negotiated. So the question is, what is that negotiation going to require to reach a kind of stabilization point? And war is definitely going to be part of the equation to some extent. How much and how significant is, I don't know. But
yeah, I mean, that was another thing that came out of the Tucker Carlson interview with Putin was the degree to which Putin seemed to accept U.S. dominance and define the Russian stance as being in reaction to U.S. action, which, I mean, like, there's an example where not so much the aims of the United States and NATO, but their ways of implementing their aims. Like, you know, he said, listen, rather than allowing for a legal process to continue in Ukraine, they set up a coup when they could have had the same outcome by legal means in a way that was allowing people to save face and would have been much more humane, and which would have been easier for, I think this was implied, for the Russian establishment to accept and manage and sell to their domestic population. But he described it as a political mistake. So Putin becomes like a critic of US power rather than an opponent to it throughout the interview. And I think that's worth noting. And the other thing that I thought was worth thinking about a little more deeply was his description of how the United States intervened, or maybe it was the EU that intervened in the Ukrainian-Russian trade relations at some point, limiting the degree to which it was possible to exchange goods back and forth over the border. Not to the degree that that stopped happening by any means. They were still major trading partners, and Ukraine still traded with Russia to a larger degree or in a more deep way than it did with Europe. But nonetheless, they interfered in that relationship. And it's interesting to think about how trade is a way, controlling trade is also a way of controlling the growth of GDP in nations and the strength of productive capacity in various regions. These trade relations are about setting up limits and also creating debts between nations on the productive capacity of various nations. So like in a way when, I mean, this hasn't worked out, but in a way when you create massive debts in one nation to a foreign, more established power, a more productive nation, that can have, theoretically, this is what the Krugmans of the world would say, tremendously beneficial effects, because that debt wants, you know, the lender wants that to be repaid. And the way that's going to be repaid is through ramping up production and increasing the power of the national economy. So what is progressive is the way in which the United States and the West will view the rising productive capacity of China or India or Russia as some sort of threat. But we should kind of examine why that should be the case in a liberal market economy, a world supposedly run through and directed by a liberal bourgeois market economy. It doesn't really make sense on the surface as to why that should be the case.
Well, I think, you know, the relationships, you know, trade relationships, diplomatic relationships that have been, you know, that have taken shape over, again, since World War II, you know, generally speaking, have become increasingly brittle over time as this kind of this arrangement, the United States is effectively the world's policeman, has become less politically sustainable for U.S. political leadership. As I was saying before, it's not as if elected officials have no control or anything like that, but they are in a sense in a tug of war with the vested interests that are already in place, both within the government and outside of it. It's not just the electorate making decisions through its political parties or something like that. Like, that obviously is not the case. If you look at the domestic politics of the United States since the 70s, mm-hmm. It's obvious that there has been a drift away from this, you know, globalization, so to speak, right? There has been increasing skepticism and hostility towards, like, this idea that the United States should play the role of securing an environment for free trade on a global scale for the benefit of the American people. That's where you get something like America First, you know, this idea, mm-hmm. America First, which, you know, from a free market, you know, kind of libertarian perspective, is just totally wrongheaded. But, you know, the thing is, Trump is not like an economic nationalist in the sense that he wants the United States to completely reel in all of its international relationships or something like that. You know, he may make kind of statements that lead people to think that at times, but it's rhetoric, and it's rhetoric with a very deliberate and clear purpose if you pay attention to what he actually says and says he wants to do, which is renegotiate these relationships so that they are more beneficial to the United States. He doesn't mm-hmm. want to get rid of this system. He just wants to revamp it in a way that is no longer declining, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether or not he would actually be able to do that, like, you know, I'm, who knows? I don't know. I don't think necessarily, but I don't think the Democrats want to do that, you know, or at least I think they're reluctant to admit that that's necessary. Certainly in terms of their political, you know, their ideological front, right?
Do you think it's fair to say that since the 70s, say, since post-Vietnam, mm-hmm. maybe, that there has been, in fact, an intensification of military conflict in the world? And if so, do you think that the increase in policing and incarceration in the United States tracks with that? That was just something that occurred to me now, that the degree to which the internal relations, the domestic relationships within the United States are fracturing is maybe paralleled on the world scene, that we have some sort of, when we can't easily employ most of the people in the United States, and we don't have living wages for most, you know, for more than half the population, or half the population doesn't mm-hmm. really have a secure living wage. That creates unrest and criminality within civil society, and then that has to be dealt with. And despite the fact that China has had a tremendous couple of decades, and there has been massive growth in the last 30 years globally, it seems to me that since 2008 we've found a kind of a breaking point, or we've hit an impasse where, you know, we just have a internal competition within these nations and then between the nations.
Yeah, I don't
It brings this military response.
Right. I don't know if there's been more or not. I mean, I just don't know, but like, I'd be inclined to think so. That might just be how things seem to me. I don't have any data or anything to confirm that, but I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. And with social decline within the United States, obviously both the rise of the prison industrial complex and this kind of insane extent of the war on drugs and all of that kind of thing. On the one hand, inflation, obviously the use of inflation as a political measure on the other, it's symptomatic of something that goes back to the New Deal and the politics of the New Deal, which is maintain, effectively full employment as a political measure. Full employment in the sense of employing as many people as you need to, not everyone. But, obviously there's always a concern to keep unemployment as low as possible and to secure that by political measures. That's really been effectively the number one concern of every election campaign since the Great Depression, or at least near the top, if not the top. It's the economy, stupid, right? Like that whole thing, the Hillary Clinton saying that worrying about people being unemployed keeps her up at night during her presidential campaign, like that sort of thing. Like, they really do want to make sure that there is as little unemployment as possible. And now obviously they fudge that in various ways. Both there's like the statistical fudging of who counts as someone who's eligible to be counted as unemployed versus out of the workforce. But then there's also, the entire population that's either incarcerated or otherwise bound up with the criminal justice system and with crime, with criminal activity as itself a kind of form of employment, but illicit employment. That's another way of managing unemployment. Inflation's another way because it allows you to allow wages to fall against the prices of commodities in real terms, and thus you can kind of even things out by driving down the value of labor power without anyone really seeing it happen. Obviously you can eventually you kind of see, wow, I'm not able to buy as much as I used to. But it's not like you're getting a direct wage cut, right? Which is the way it used to happen. They used to say, we're cutting your wages. Now the dollar just depreciates and that even things out. So, there's all sorts of, you could go on and on. I mean, the entire sector of government employment and for that matter, the nonprofit industrial complex is also absorbing a lot of surplus labor. That is it really necessary for those things to be done, or at least done in that way? That's not to say that like the libertarian position that like whatever they are doing that's necessary would be better done by private enterprise is necessarily true. But it's certainly not producing, it's not adding to the GDP, right? So I don't know. It's, I feel like I lost the track of your question now.
Well, what we're talking about is the way in the contradictions in the economy.
Oh, right.
Right. That have been.
So that, that's what I meant.
Militarization. Yeah.
Right. So there's been an increasing destabilization of this political, way of managing capitalism over, since the 70s, you could say, domestically. And that I definitely would think that correlates to the same sort of destabilization internationally as well. It's obviously very complicated, but a big part of the way things are manifesting now, I think, has to be a consequence of the fact that the people in charge in the United States have to deal with the discontents of the domestic population. So they're not able to have as free a hand as they might want. And I think the more that that's the case, the more you see this kind of this kind of cognitive dissonance with respect to like the media picture of things versus what makes more kind of sense in terms of just like a, you don't even have to have a lot of inside information just to think this seems really implausible. The stuff that they're saying is true. It just seems very hard to swallow.
Like, give me an example of one of the things that they say that you think is implausible.
that Joe Biden is like a competent president, and that he's not senile and shouldn't be. I mean, the man should be in bed. You know, it's horrible seeing them parade him out. I mean, that's just an obvious go-to, but you know, I mean, look at the wars that are going on, like how they're talked about. That, you know, the notion that the war in Ukraine is like valiant freedom fighters against an evil dictator. Again, I'm not saying that Putin is a good guy or should be doing what he's doing at all. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is the whole reason this conflict is happening is because of the way the United States managed the dissolution of the Soviet Union from 1991 till, you know, 2014, you know, and on from there as well. You know, it is a consequence of the way the United States managed that situation.
Yeah, but to say that is maybe, I mean, I think that's true, right? It is true. It's also, though, the consequence of the way the Soviet Union managed its own crack up. It's also, you know, a consequence of the way the Ukrainians manage their own internal and external problems. That these things are all like, the United States is coming in after the fact, or, you know, as a police force, as you said, to try to manage crises and criminality on the global scene. And you know, in a criminal way, like cops usually do. But it's not as though the cause of these problems are the cops. The cops are a symptom of the problems. And so the question for working people is, how do we overcome our problems, these problems ourselves? These people in Washington and in Moscow aren't going to do it for us. They're just not. And so, I mean, and that's when you think about how important employment is and what the point of the sanctions against Russia were. It was a punishment for the working class of Russia.
Well, it was trying to politically destabilize Putin's regime on that basis, right?
Right. It was to say, we're going to reduce your ability to be productive, reduce your ability to fully employ your people, make their lives a lot more difficult, and thereby put your administration, put the Putin regime under political threat. Yeah. You know, meanwhile, the CIA is funding separatist movements in the Caucasus and would love to support dissidents, and I'm sure is. So, but all of that is about the influencing the working class in Russia to trying to direct them towards particular political actions. And the what needs to happen, I mean, I'm such a doctrinaire Marxist thing to say, but it's true, is that for the working class to take up its own political project there, because and refuse to be directed by either Putin or Washington. That Washington is not going to direct the working class to overcome the basic problem that's creating all these conditions and that caused the crack up of the Soviet Union and is causing the crack up of the NATO countries in the West at the moment.
That's true, but I would also add, it's not just about the kind of police function, mm-hmm. because there is an integral role of the United States as well in terms of the economic relationships, both politically mm-hmm. mediated and directly with respect to economic actors. Again, the shock therapy policy was something that was essentially forced on Russia mm-hmm. by, I don't know if it was the World Trade Organization or the IMF or what it was, but it was, you know, that was kind of a condition that was imposed upon them. The way in which the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact was managed as well, the idea was, this is how it has to be in order for us to play ball. Right.
What was it about the W2F's, the Clintonite World Economic Forum WTF's approach to Russia that was so detrimental?
Well, I don't know if it was the WTF, but I had said I'm not sure if it was the IMF or the WTO. I mean, I guess
WTO probably, and the IMF, I combined them.
I guess the IMF, probably WTO, have
a, they were all right. were involved.
Jeffrey right. Sachs. Sorry. Jeffrey right. Sachs.
WTO.
The shock there. Well, so I didn't mean
and to not Mexico, but Egypt. Okay, go ahead.
the shock therapy doctrine was essentially liquidate everything. You know, liquidate all of the state assets, remove all of the regulations. You know, it's almost overnight. There was this radical, you know, essentially the entirety of the Russian economy was bound up in the state, not in the sense that it was all controlled by the state, but, it's the same. It would be like, the same thing if you liquidated all of the biggest, companies in the United States. I mean, that would be actually probably pretty different in various ways. But I mean, you can imagine like liquidating all of the economic assets in a country or the overwhelming preponderance overnight. It led to and then of course what ended up happening with those assets is that they were
selling the assets. That's what it means to liquidate them. Right.
Selling off the state assets, which they were promptly scooped up by a tiny minority of very powerful people that were empowered by the United States. And that wealth was taken out of Russia and put into, it wasn't reinvested in Russia, right? It was, the Russian people were kind of left to hang. And they suffered dramatically, incredibly because of that.
Why didn't the private businessmen in Russia who bought up the state assets take those assets and reinvest them in the Russian economy?
It was less profitable than holding on to them or investing them somewhere else. I mean, it's just that simple. I mean, you really had kind of social chaos in a lot of ways. I studied this decades ago now, and I don't have all the details fresh in my mind, but it was not, I guess you could say it wasn't an environment that was conducive to doing business for some time.
Why didn't the Russian state, which had sold off the assets, take the money and reinvest in the Russian economy? What was it? I mean, like, another approach would have been for the West to directly invest in the Russian state and industry to build up the productive forces of Russia, right? Which would have been the same thing. They would have been buying up, in a sense, through loans that had to be repaid, but they would have been having some significant say in the role that the state took in reshaping the economy. In other words, you'd make loans with some strings attached and a payment plan. And, you know, when someone invests, like if someone were to invest in Sublation Media to a large degree, they would be buying it up.
Right.
You know, and so the question is, why, if someone did that, why wouldn't I go turn around and take the millions of dollars or billions of dollars from Peter Thiel and reinvest it in Sublation Media? Why would I instead decide to go and, I don't know, and buy Apple stocks or something and live on an island? Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. I don't really have an answer. I mean, you know, I could tell you the ideology behind it, which is that the best thing for Russia would have been to suddenly open up the market in this dramatic way, because it would have, you know, yes, there probably was anticipated, a certain level of destabilization and, economic, I don't know how to put it gently, but, depreciation of economic conditions to such an extent that it becomes, attractive as a site of investment, in the sense that, it's wide open, a wide open field, cheap labor, cheap land, et cetera. And you basically, I think the assumption was between the wealth, that was, kind of generated through the, selling off of state assets and the opening up of foreign investment, you'd basically have a lot of economic activity. At least that was the idea. You know, do you ever see that Pizza Hut
commercial?
Maybe
the problem was not that the things weren't purchased, that not enough was bought up and at a too low a price. Maybe that was the problem. Is that?
Maybe again, I
got a bad deal.
I don't have like the data in front of me, and I did study this a long time ago, but I think of that. Did you ever see that Pizza Hut commercial from?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm.
Where the Russians are debating about whether it's a good or a bad thing that the Soviet Union's coming to an end, and the conclusion is, well, now we can have Pizza Hut in Russia.
Yeah, which means we can take 6 months of our wages and go to Pizza Hut. Once.
Right. And but that's the ideology. Now, what was actually underlying that? Was there some cynical scheme to just like devastate Russia? There may very well have been some people that had that perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think there was probably a lot of people that were, I don't know. I mean, I think there was probably a lot of things going on behind the scenes. I mean, at the end of the day, we're not talking about like a conspiratorial cabal that deliberately made this happen. There may have been some faction pushing towards that sort of an outcome, but it's a very complicated system of negotiation between different parties, mm-hmm. at play here. So exactly how everything shuffles out, I don't know. I'm not the person to ask about that, but I suspect that there were some people that were just willing to say, yeah, let the Russians suffer. And, eventually things will turn around, or maybe we just want Russia to be a kind of devastated country that has a very, very hard time recovering from that. Or maybe it really was expected by some people that there would be this economic miracle as a result of shock therapy, which a lot of people certainly were saying that would happen. So, I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably a lot more complicated than saying it was actually, this is what someone wanted to happen. And, to really know that, you would have to have a kind of an insider perspective I don't have. So,
well, if you are working for a boss, that boss has more power if the general conditions in your city are such that there's a lot of unemployment.
Certainly, certainly. Right? And of course you want to have a depreciation of wages, or unemployment for that matter. Of course you want that, but it's not like you want that because you want the workers to suffer. You want that because it stimulates economic activity. It stimulates investment. And ultimately, in the long run, again, ostensibly, the idea is it would be to the benefit of everyone or the majority of people. Now, whether
but on the other hand, though, if you're a boss, if you're a boss and there's a massive amount of unemployment, you're going to have trouble getting the things you need to run your business. Those things might be very expensive. It's going to work against your business to have not enough people buying your product because too many people are unemployed. So on the one hand, you want unemployment. On the other hand, you don't. And I think that's sort of the situation for most world leaders, especially in regards to other nations. They kind of want them to be productive and participating in the world economy. And on the other hand, they don't.
That's why the state has to play this role of balancing these interests against each other. Both within any given domestic context, but also on the global scale, that's really the role that the United States plays within various countries, including the United States itself, but also between the various countries at play. It has to have this effect of balancing these competing interests in such a way that things remain stable enough to continue, growing, the economy continues growing as much as is possible. And whether or not the state is actually competent to do that, ultimately it isn't. Ultimately, it's always going to, at some point, run up against some kind of limit that induces a crisis that it couldn't foresee or prevent. But then, you make the most of that, right? And ultimately, that's a chance for even more, an even greater boom after the fact, whether or not it ends up felling certain regimes or ruining a lot of people's lives in the process.
One thing I'll say to kind of round this out or to, in addition to what I said and what you said, is that unlike the state, it is always in the interests of workers to have as many people employed as possible. I can't think of an exception where, you know, having jobs be plentiful and almost everyone, you know, and fully employed would be to anyone's disadvantage as a worker.
Well, so, you know, Marx has an interesting comment in this regard, which is that, mm-hmm. You know, that the working class needs to, and this is going to maybe be controversial. I could pull up the exact quote, but to paraphrase, that the working class needs to occasionally essentially get knocked down in order to maintain its, I forget the exact phrasing he uses, but, you know, essentially if things maintain like a kind of a level of stabilization for too long, the working class becomes complacent and adapted to its condition. Whereas when you have the industrial cycle acting in a way that there are periodic upheavals that throw a lot of people out of work, they get really agitated and want to do something about that, right? It drives them to organize themselves to mitigate or to ultimately to overcome this dynamic. Whereas if political management is preventing that from happening, it allows the working class to be degraded to the level of a kind of complacent acceptance of their slavery. So, right. So that, you know, I mean, yes, you want as many people to be employed as possible, but the dynamic of capitalism, you know, at least on its own terms, would be, you know, at a certain point that level of high employment correlates to a tipping point from a boom to a downward trend that culminates in an economic crisis, mm-hmm. leading to a lot of people being thrown out of work. So you really need both sides of that equation. You need the upswing and the downswing, and you need to be prepared to take advantage of both sides of it, politically speaking, from a socialist perspective.
Sure. But I would just say in this moment that I think, like, one of the consequences of the failure of the liberal market capitalist economy to live up to its stated goals and integrate Russia into mm-hmm. the system is that we're being asked to accept a certain level of unemployment and unproductivity in lack of productivity in huge parts of the world as normal. And we shouldn't think of that as adequate or as approaching full employment, and should remember that it's actually in our interest for the people of Russia to have a productive, successful lives, even as workers. And that might be a grounds for some sort of solidarity between the nations, I would hope. And so, I don't know, that's maybe my Pollyanna Marxism that I will end this first half of the stream with. In the second half, we're going to try to cancel Marx, maybe. Oh, we can talk more about Putin and Tucker too, because there's a couple more other things to say there. But yeah, join us in the Parrot Room, which will be starting up in about 10 minutes. I'll put a link in the description and the comments. And thanks everybody for watching the first half.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living